101.3 FM in Guelph. My name is Sarah. I'm going to update my blog. Sometimes I just don't update it, but I'm going to update my blog today or tomorrow. So check it out, these things at peoplemake.blogspot.com. That was Ray Spoon with You Can Dance off his new album, Love is a Hunter. He's launching it in Toronto tonight at the Gladstone Hotel. Don't miss it. Doors open at 8 o'clock. And Abigail Appel, who's also a fantastic songwriter, is going to be performing. And next week starting, well, not even, this Saturday, the funding drive starts at CFRU. It's going on for 9 days. There's lots of events happening, and there's lots of great shows being planned right now. So please don't forget to donate money in support of this station. We survive and are able to produce content because the funding drive happens, and people like you who are listening donate a little bit of money in support of this station. We operate on a very, very tiny budget and are trying to do really good things. So if you like what you hear, and if you like these things that people make, please consider donating to my show. If you want to, you can send me an email at sarah.mankel@gmail.com. Any donation is awesome, and I'm going to be making homemade things for everybody who donates to my show. So I'm going to turn on Groundwire now, and then Democracy Now! Will be up after Groundwire, and then Radio Oberg will be up after that. So it's going to be a great day. Keep your radio on, and stay warm.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. I'm your host, Vince Tingley. In this edition...
No pipelines! No tankers! No tar sands!
These are not the first migrant workers that are part of the program that have passed away.
Clearly part of an agenda that is not looking to produce a peaceful resolution of the crisis in the Middle East.
But first, we bring you a special roundup of grassroots national news across Canada. Ralston White and Paul Roach were two Jamaican men who had been working under the Canadian Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program at Phil Singer Farms near Owen Sound, Ontario. In September, they became the latest victims of clear workspace health and safety violations. Migrant agricultural workers like the late Ralston and Paul grow, harvest, and process much of the food Canadians enjoy, but instead of feasting at the dinner table this past Thanksgiving weekend, a great many of migrant workers from Ontario fields, farms, and factories will undertake Justicia for migrant workers' first pilgrimage to freedom. This is an arduous march of more than 50 kilometers from Leamington to Windsor's Monument for Freedom, dedicated to the Underground Railroad that brought slaves to freedom in Canada. Sazna, with Justicia for Migrant Workers, talks about why.
The reason why we're asking for SNAP inspections is that workplaces are sometimes or generally inspected for health and safety purposes before everybody comes, before farm workers come from the Caribbean and from Mexico. But then they're never inspected, or they're very rarely inspected while people are working there, which, you know, is very different. So we want health and safety standards to be enforced. So they passed away, and these are not the first migrant workers that are part of the program that have passed away. It happens very often, and so this time we are demanding that the Ministry of Labor make changes to the program, and we're also demanding that there's a coroner's inquest started about the deaths, which rarely happens or never happens.
In the wake of last month's Ontario Supreme Court decision to uphold a ban on blood donated by gay men, many in the gay community are countering the decision with increased information on new HIV infections. Canadian Blood Services had sued 36-year-old Kyle Freeman for negligent misrepresentation after the gay man concealed his sexual identity on the standard blood donor form.
Douglas Elliott is a leading constitutional lawyer, and he represented the Canadian AIDS Society in the Freeman case.
The Canadian AIDS Society has had a long-standing interest in the protection of the blood supply. In fact, it goes back to before the existence of the Canadian Blood Services. We were an active participant in the Creever Commission that led to the creation of the Canadian Blood Services. We believe very strongly that the safety of the blood supply is important, and the safety of the blood supply when it comes to gay sex and the risk of HIV transmission depends on very much on the cooperation of the gay community. We believe in order to have an effective blood screening process, you have to have a question that's scientifically sound and that has the respect and cooperation of the gay community. This question was scientifically sound and had the respect of most people in the gay community when it was introduced over 20 years ago, but it's now scientifically unjustified and overly broad, and the position of the Canadian AIDS Society is that it should be changed. We've been advocating for change for a long time, and certainly we think that at a minimum, one could safely change it to a period of celibacy of 5 years rather than the current period of 33 years.
So you're not opposed to a question that asks about sex with men?
No, it's clear that some kinds of sex with men carries with it a risk of HIV transmission. Although all blood is tested right now and the HIV test is highly accurate.
Freeman had argued that the question on sexual orientation violated his constitutional right to equal treatment, and also that the policy further perpetrated the Canadian public's belief that all gay men must have HIV and or AIDS. Canada's fastest growing HIV demographic is young heterosexual women, who already make up 25% of all HIV infections in the country. To campus news now. McGill students returning to school last month had to do so without their bicycles. A new rule banning bike riding on campus was implemented by the university on May 28th and came into full effect as students returned to campus last month. The administration claims the rule was devised to prioritize pedestrian use of the campus, but students who rely on their bikes to get around campus say the university is unnecessarily antagonizing students. The administration claims that there have been several accidents in the past with cyclists, though they have not been able to show any statistics to that effect. The McGill Tribune claims that these accidents occurred while cars were still allowed on campus, and that cyclists and pedestrians behave differently and are able to coexist better once cars are gone. Administration has said that they may explore some flexibility with the new rule for hours of the day when the campus is less busy, though the new rule creates borders between road users that could make it difficult to reintegrate in the future. Further, concerns have been raised about the lack of serious research or consultation regarding the new rule, and that no alternatives were considered and suggested. Thanks to the Canadian University Press for that story. In other campus news, Vancouver-based mining company Goldcorp announced that they would be donating $10 million to Simon Fraser University to fund the school's art center in the already controversial Woodwards Building in the downtown east side. The school will be known as the Goldcorp Center for the Arts. SFU students quickly met on October 1st and mobilized against the donation based on Goldcorp's environmental and human rights record. According to Mining Watch, Goldcorp's San Martin mine in Honduras poisoned community members, displaced an entire village from their lands, and affected the water supply to the extent that farming and ranching families were forced to migrate out of the area. In Guatemala, the company's Marlin mine is located on what was previously communally held indigenous Mayan Mam lands. One person was killed by police at a roadblock preventing mine construction. Recently, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission ruled that the Marlin mine must be shut down, but the company has refused to abide by their ruling. In California, the company recently lost a Chapter 11 dispute under NAFTA. Goldcorp has claimed that they had the right to bulldoze sacred Quechen indigenous sites and has failed in seeking government reimbursement for the costs Goldcorp incurred mitigating damage in sacred areas.
Nicholas is an organizer with the Teaching Support Staff Union at SFU.
That the administration doesn't have any accountability towards the faculty or the students. It was, I mean, almost literally there's an opening ceremony for this new school and they rip a sheet off of a plaque and all of a sudden we find out that it's the Goldcorp Center for the Contemporary Arts. And there is something in the works right now. Hopefully next week we'll have some sort of action. A lot of the grad students are planning something for November the 9th that'll be a little bit more extensive in a number of different programs, I believe, urban studies and somewhere else that are actually already doing research on this company that sort of like lay out their actual business practices.
Of the donation to Simon Fraser University, Goldcorp officials had this to say. Goldcorp is committed to making a positive difference here in Vancouver as well as those communities where we operate our mines, said Goldcorp President and Chief Executive Officer Chuck Gines. Now time for a short break. We'll be back with more Groundwire Community Radio news.
on the ground, in your community. Groundwire is a listener-supported project of the National Campus Community Radio Association. Support community radio news. Support Groundwire by donating now at ncra.ca.
Welcome back to Groundwire, brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. Now it's time for our feature stories. Jennifer Moreau takes a look at the Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism. Is the group fighting a worldwide resurgence of attacks on Jewish people, or is it an attempt to silence critics of Israel? We'll hear from university professor Michael Kiefer and Vancouver MP Hedy Fry, who is working with the coalition.
Can you tell me just briefly about the book you've written?
I don't want to suggest I'm the single author of this book. It originated as a collection of texts that were effectively rejected by the Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism. Texts written by individual human rights activists, a majority of whom in this case happen to be Jewish, and also texts written by human rights organizations.
What concerns do you have about this Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism?
Well, it was quite clear from the beginning that they set out to conduct an inquiry having already arrived at their conclusions. And their conclusions were quite simply inflammatory.
And as far as the concern that anti-Semitism is on the rise, how does one measure that?
That's complex, and there's an entire long chapter in the book devoted to that, in which I went through statistical evidence from Canada, from the United Kingdom, and from other countries as well, but those two in particular, with an eye to assessing what different kinds of evidence were available and how, what in effect the story is that they tell us. And the story they tell us is of a general decline, very significant decline, in anti-Semitic prejudice, with possibilities of a reversal of that decline caused in part by the very thing that the CPCCA is engaged in, conflations of actions of the State of Israel with the opinions of Jews in general.
Is this an official parliamentary committee?
No, it's actually not a parliamentary committee at all. It has no authority from Parliament. Its terms of reference were not set by Parliament. It is a group of MPs who got together, defined their own terms of reference in ways that I think were rash and ill-advised, and quite clearly have an agenda that involves, I would say, an intimidation of people who want to speak out on human rights issues in this country. The coalition did say initially that it would reveal all sources of its funding and assured Canadians that its mission would in no sense be compromised by funding it accepted. The only small bit of information we have about their non-governmental funding is that they've received some degree of funding from a foundation that also supports very aggressive Zionist organizations in the United States and supports the resettlement of Jewish settlers who had occupied land in Gaza into villages on territory owned by Israeli Bedouin.
The title of the event tonight is Criticize Israel, Go to Jail. So why do you think this coalition is trying to criminalize criticism of Israel?
The title of the talk tonight has a question mark at the end. So it's not an assertion. It's quite clear that the model that the coalition is adopting is one that's been enunciated very clearly by one of its prime movers and organizers, Professor Erwin Kotler, Member of Parliament, former Member of Justice in the Liberal government, who speaks of what he calls lawfare. What he means by that is that human rights discourse critical of Israel is to be understood as a form of displaced warfare, which I find a very peculiar notion, but is to be answered by a return mobilization of legal resources against people who criticize actions of the State of Israel.
Why should Canadians be concerned about the work of this coalition?
I think we should be concerned about it because of its vehemently unbalanced nature. An honest inquiry into this issue, I think, would be welcomed by most Canadians. One other very good reason for opposing the work of this coalition is that it is clearly part of an agenda that is not looking to produce a peaceful resolution of the crisis in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine, and is certainly orienting Canada toward an even more unbalanced position in regard to that conflict.
I was asked to go to this all-party conference put on by the British Parliament in London to discuss issues of what is they see as being a rise in anti-Semitism. And in Europe, there was a huge rise of swastika-carrying groups marching in the streets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there had, we had also had evidence that there was a rise in Latin America of the same sort of thing. And so what interested nations did, and about 20 nations came to it, to talk about how they could document whether this is happening in their countries, and if so, what do they need to do to deal with the issue. Then most countries went back home and they looked at setting up committees to document whether there was or there wasn't. But one of the things that we found was that there was no definition for anti-Semitism, that really there was no documentation that actually the police were looking at, because people didn't document it according to that. They just documented hate crimes. So that basically one was looking at, do we have evidence of different types of hate crimes? What specific group in society or religion in society or ethnicity in society in Canada was it aimed at?
So as far as the work of the committee goes, what did you find then?
Well, I can't tell you because the committee is still writing its report. The committee will put its report out. It will be put out on the website. It would be available to everyone. One of the questions you asked was who's funding the committee.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not an official parliamentary committee, it has no funding. Lots of committees that people set up have no funding. Some people donated money. I think one of the multiculturalism minister put a little bit of money into it. But what people were doing was working off a shoestring.
And who is the report going to be released to?
The public, I guess.
But is it also going to someone in government, or?
No, it's going to be sent to every parliamentarian. It's going to be put out on its own website.
So Kiefer's main criticism of the coalition is that it's trying to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. So I was curious what you thought about this.
Well, I don't know how he could suggest what the committee is trying to do when he obviously hasn't seen the report. I think the issue, however, some witnesses have said that they felt that a lot of people who did not want to be overtly anti-Semitic and, you know, run around using swastikas and stuff were saying that what they weren't anti-Jewish, they were just anti-Israel. And there was the question was, were they? We don't know. We heard some people telling us that.
There was a lot of speculation from Kiefer and his supporters that this coalition is somehow trying to criminalize criticism of Israel.
I think what you'd have to do is to wait and see the report. That is not why I'm on that committee.
Based on your work with the coalition, have you seen a rise in cases of anti-Semitism?
So there have been, and I don't know, and I can't tell you what the committee is going to report, but I will say that it has been sporadic over the years in Canada.
Why is the work of the coalition important?
Under the Charter, under Section 15 of the Charter, these groups have a right to be treated equally under the law, have to live free from hate and the ability to find jobs and the ability to live in societies free of discrimination.
Now an exclusive interview from VoicePrint Canada.
And now an excerpt from VoicePrint's interview program, Contact. The following is an excerpt from an interview with Charles Beer on the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. Mr. Beer is a former member of Provincial Parliament in the Ontario Legislature. Last year, he was appointed by the Ontario government to review the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. One of the conditions of the legislation, informally known as the AODA, is the act be reviewed every 5 years. Mr. Beer held public hearings across the province, hearing from representatives of the disability community, public and private sector stakeholders, on the status of the legislation. Earlier this year, Mr. Beer submitted his review of the legislation, as well as his recommendations on what the government can do to ensure the act is fully implemented by 2025. Charles Beer spoke with VoicePrint's Catherine MacDonald.
Now, your review, as you mentioned, is the first of, I guess, what's going to be a series of 5-year reviews. What was the aim of this first review? What were the specific questions you were hoping to answer?
There are, as you say, in the legislation, which is a fairly unique thing in and of itself, that these reviews are mandated. And so the kind of review that I've done, the legislation stated that this would be done first after 4 years and then every 3 years. So between now and 2025, if that were to happen, as you say, there would be several more of these reviews. In addition, with each new standard, within 5 years of that standard becoming law, there has to be review of the standard itself. So, for example, customer service became law January 1, 2008. So at some point in 2013, there would have to be a review of that standard, and then again in 2018 and so on. And I think the value of those reviews then just means that they can be updated, that there be an opportunity for everyone to be involved to make sure that that the standard was truly what it should be. So in my review, as I mentioned before, because all the standards were not in place, and in fact there is a process to review them, I was really asked to focus more on looking at how we arrived at the point where we are. How were the standards developed? How did that process work? How did the system in effect work? And are there some things perhaps that could be recommended to improve that whole process? I was asked to look at a previous piece of legislation called the ODA, the Ontarians with Disabilities Act, because that act still exists and is still in force. And so one of the questions is, ultimately, there should be just one piece of legislation. So how to merge the ODA and AODA, and I made recommendations on that. And how was the public information and public awareness about the AODA, how had that been handled, and were people sufficiently aware of the act and knowing what they needed to do? And then finally, just looking at the work of the government and the secretariat that been set up, the directorate, to implement the AODA. My work was, you could probably say, looking at process and trying to give some sense of what it worked and how it had worked, and what kinds of changes could be proposed so that the next 15 years prior to 2025 could really be well used and ensure that Ontario meets the intent of the legislation. The one point that I'd really want to underline is that in the various consultations that I held with people in different parts of the province, I found overwhelming support for the principles and intent of the legislation and the belief that it was really important for Ontario to do this. Clearly, there were some issues around the how, but I was quite struck by the strength and conviction of people, not just in the disability community, but from all the various obligated sectors, as they're called.
That was Charles Beer on his report reviewing the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, provided to Groundwire, courtesy of VoicePrint. To hear this interview in its entirety, please visit their website at voiceprintcanada.com.
Now it's time for the Community Radio Report. A Wet'suwet'en Nation Reserve and the community of Fort Chipewyan have both established their own community radio stations. Both communities are at the forefront of Indigenous opposition to tar sands developments. Sakura Saunders has long helped community radio stations get established, and she edits protestbarrack.net. She witnessed and took part in the establishment of both stations. This interview was first broadcast on Worm's Eye View, grassroots news on CJSF 90.1 FM.
So how did you get involved in building these two stations?
And so I met Mike Mercury from the Fort Chipewyan community through his advocacy around the tar sands. And then I also met Warner Nazel and Mel Basil from the Wet'suwet'en territories. I met them at the Everyone's Downstream conference, which is organized around resistance to the tar sands. And both Mike and Warner especially were interested in having me come to the communities and set something up. So at this point, what we did was a number of radio workshops. So we would turn on the station, for example, at the high school graduation party. And we had a lot of the youth practice being on the air and practice doing radio shows and also playing their favorite songs from their iPods just to get them, you know, kind of involved in the radio station. We also did trainings on, you know, audio editing and things like that. But I really think that
with that community. They want to have a system in place before they start doing 24/7 broadcasting. That community very intentionally wants to use the radio station as an educational resource for the community. And so now that they've given the community a taste of what it is to have community radio, they're going to, set some systems in place before they start broadcasting 24/7. But on the other hand, the radio station that I helped set up in Fort Chipewyan, which is a downstream tar sands community in northern Alberta, they're broadcasting 24/7. When there's no live DJ, it's just, iTunes with a number of different playlists on random play. And that community station, it's one of two radio stations, period, in town. And so it not only wants to be an educational resource, but also an entertainment resource for the community.
And how did people in this community receive it?
The radio station is called FCBC, Four Chip by Chip. And, we spray painted Mike's car and drove around promoting the station in its first couple of days. And his phone was ringing off the hook with texts and with phone calls, people making requests. And I just feel like we got a lot of community engagement from the get-go. And people were scheming about, what types of shows they could do. And it was really exciting to see. In Wet'suwet'en Territory, they used to have a radio station that was run by the First Nation people themselves. But one day, somebody came in and stole all the equipment. And so they lost that resource, and a lot of people really appreciated it, especially listening to that radio station.
No pipelines! No tankers! No tar sands! No pipelines! No tankers!
Fort Chip is downstream from the actual tar sands mines, and there are high cancer rates there. And the Wet'suwet'en Nation is opposing the construction of the Enbridge pipeline, which would bring tar sands oil across their territory. How does this factor into what kind of stuff you would hear on their stations?
There's a lot of education work that's being done through the radio station. So, for example, as part of the action camp, we had a rally and march, a really festive march throughout Smithers, which is a big town in the area. And, we stopped at various sites within Smithers that are somehow connected to the forestry industry, the mining industry, or the Enbridge pipeline, and also CN Rail, as it's connected to the tar sands. And at each stop, we heard a number of speeches from both local people and folks from other First Nations that came out of solidarity for the Wet'suwet'en people. So those recorded speeches were played on the radio station when we had it running. Their analysis really incorporates a lot of solidarity work. So, for example, they actually did a protest in solidarity with the refugees that came in by the boat, the Tamil refugees. Also, they're against carbon credits. And this is one of the things that really impressed me so much about the Wet'suwet'en people when I heard their hereditary chief, Warner, speak about this issue. They're being approached to sell carbon, basically receive money for preserving their own forests. So in a sense, they just get all the positive aspect of these carbon credits. But because they know that those carbon credits will facilitate the expansion and justify the expansion of the tar sands, they are against accepting that money. And so I was just extremely impressed with that community, and they're using the radio station definitely more as an educational piece. In the Fort Chipewyan community, the situation is a little bit different. The radio station isn't as explicitly political. And, of course, we slipped in, educational speeches. Many of the speeches actually from the Wet'suwet'en Action Camp were played on the radio, as well as other spoken word pieces. But definitely the feel for that radio station is not as explicitly political. And the reason that Mike wanted to do it that way is because, everyone knows about the tar sands. When you have a community